Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, Speaker Pro Tem Lori Pohutsky takes listeners behind the scenes on the crafting of this year's and prior year's Pride Month resolution. Entrepreneur Michael Hoover lays out his case as to why he should be Michigan's next U.S. Senator. And in an ideal world, how much should the governor, attorney general, secretary of state, and legislators make? Tom Cochran, chair of the State Officers Compensation Commission, gives his opinions. Now here's Samantha Schreiber with Kyle Malin and Danielle James.
Thank you, Jeff Smith, who's helping us produce the podcast for the week. It's me, MERS's State Senate reporter Sam Schreiber, with our editor Kyle Malin and our House reporter Danielle James. And we're kicking off the initial segment of today's show with House Speaker Pro Tem and head of the Progressive Women's Caucus in the Michigan Legislature, Rep. Lori Pohutsky. And today follows last week, where the House was able to adopt its Pride resolution. Lori Pohutsky, can you tell us a bit more about this resolution and what it means when you think about the history of Pride in the state legislature?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you all for having me. And particularly to talk about this topic. You know, this is something that we had introduced, I mean, before I was there, obviously, but even in my first couple terms, with no real expectation that it would be adopted. And in my first term, it was not. We introduced it. It went nowhere. But in my second term, at that point in time, it was myself and Tim Sneller, as far as out members in the House, and then Senator Moss over in the Senate on his own. And the Senate adopted it, which was a surprise. So it was kind of like this mad dash to see what the House was going to do. And the speaker at the time, Jason Wentworth, was willing to adopt it. But there were some caveats that I assume we're going to talk about. I addressed them in my floor speech. But it was kind of this weird mix of emotions for me, because it wasn't just a full-throated support of something that frankly was so uncontroversial at that point in time. You know, Pride is just something that communities all across Michigan, including communities that you don't typically think of as being progressive leaning or anything like that, have embraced. So the fact that it was still a fight and that there were still conditions on it was a little frustrating, but also knowing that was probably going to be the only thing that we were going to be able to celebrate as the LGBTQ community with that legislature. So it was a little bit of emotional whiplash.
You know, when you think about history with this Republican-led legislature before the new majority, you know, you went from having no Pride resolutions at all, then it gets adopted in both chambers in 2021, and then 2022, the election year, comes around, and you have the resolution in the Senate getting sent to government operations, and then you have the House resolution taking it from an LGBTQ plus Pride month to an LGBTQ plus Pride week. Why was 2022 this time where we saw that one initial progression essentially get stomped?
That's a great question. So over in the Senate, you know, then Senate Majority Leader Shirky did not want to adopt the Pride resolution that was adopted the year before with very little controversy. He tried negotiating, I guess is the term that can be used, with Senator Moss about including language about essentially homosexuality being a choice and that not everyone agrees with the lifestyle. And frankly, language that it's not that anyone in the community is unfamiliar with it. You know, I mean, we're very well acquainted with that type of discrimination and that thought process. But to demand that be put into a resolution honoring the month of Pride was a slap in the face. And again, completely unnecessary and uncalled for, given how the resolution had passed the year before. So that was why it didn't get adopted in the Senate, because Jeremy refused to take that compromise. And I applaud him for it. I mean, I think that was the right call. We're not going to adopt something that basically codifies homophobia in a resolution. So I applaud him for that. And then over in the House, there was a back and forth, you know, once again, about whether or not I would be able to introduce it. And, you know, if my name had to come off, and it did. And because of the timing that took, the rules that frankly were suspended for the majority not infrequently, about when something recognized an entire month needed to be turned in suddenly became very, very concrete and very, very important. So we were not allowed to adopt a resolution naming anything a month because we had, you know, missed the deadline. And as frustrating as that is, I mean, that is the nature of being in the minority, right? I understood that. And what I will say, and what I didn't really get to flesh out in the speech I gave for the passage of this resolution this year, just because of, you know, House rules and time, and I was already given a fair bit of latitude, but Speaker Wentworth did not have to do what he did. I think he would have adopted a Pride Month resolution if we had not had to blow past the deadline and the back and forth about who would sponsor it. But even just Pride Week, I mean, we had some very honest conversations that I appreciate where he just said, I want this to happen, but I'm also not going to spend political capital to get my members who are viscerally upset about this to be okay with suspending rules to get a full month in there. So if you can make it work, then we'll make it work. But it's just, it was not worth his political capital. And I don't have to like that. That doesn't have to feel good. It doesn't. But I appreciate him just being honest about that and him being willing to get something there for the community.
You know, I'm curious, can you walk us through some of your feelings at that time, you know, being a member of the LGBTQ community and watching that unfold? And then could you talk a little bit about this year and how it went differently?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so again, Tim and I were under the impression that this was not going to pass. So it was going to be a name on a resolution that no one ever heard anything about other than maybe a couple of social media posts. And then when it got adopted, we were very, very excited. And then I was immediately called back with Tim and told by my leadership that the deal was we could not speak to it, which was frankly unsurprising and you know, fine by me, but also that my name had to come off it.
And Representative, if I could, what was the problem with your name? I mean, why were you singled out? What did you hear back on that?
So again, I didn't really get to go too far into this in the speech, but I talked to Speaker Wentworth about it. And again, I want to give him credit because I don't expect him, or I didn't expect him to twist arms in his caucus over a commemorative resolution and my name being on top of it. There were members of his caucus that just did not want the resolution to pass to begin with and certainly did not want my name on it. I'm completely aware that I am a tough pill to swallow for some people, and particularly folks who are not okay with the LGBTQ community. They are not okay with a mouthy, tiny, bisexual Democrat on top of it. So there were issues with that. And frankly, I was still a marginal seat at that point in time. So I think that the leadership in my own caucus was perfectly fine with my name not being on it because I was already aware that they were uncomfortable with me being open about my sexual orientation. So, you know, I made reference to the fact that I think that conversation was pretty well done before I even entered into the room. So, you know, those were the decisions that had to be made. And when it came down to it, it was frustrating and it was hurtful because this was going to be the first time in history we got this done. And I was excited for it. But at the same time, we had people, and again, not Speaker Wentworth, but he was having to navigate his own caucus at that time. We had people who did not believe the LGBTQ community should have rights dictating who would get to be a sponsor on a resolution that they didn't even care about. And there was a bit of me that felt disappointed in myself and had this internal struggle, albeit very briefly, because we didn't have a whole lot of time to decide this, that I felt like I was basically cheapening the whole point of the resolution and this historic moment by capitulating and allowing people who were not going to do anything substantive, right? This was a symbolic resolution. You know, I mean, it was nice and it was something that we could celebrate because it never happened in this state before, but it was symbolic. It wasn't guaranteeing anyone protections. It wasn't guaranteeing anyone recourse from discrimination. And that was never going to happen. So there was a part of me that felt very guilty for capitulating with people who were going to deny us those same rights over something as symbolic symbolic as this resolution, but at the same time, I knew that we were never going to get anything that session to celebrate, and this was going to be it. And I didn't want to tank it, sully that moment for the community just because of whose name was going to be at the top of it.
So not only do Dems hold the gavel now, but members of the LGBTQ community hold gavels now. But when you think about next year, when it comes time to get this resolution pushed out again, are you concerned about what the rhetoric might look like with next year being an election year, with next year having various elections overshadowed by the Ron DeSantis versus Donald Trump rhetoric?
I don't think that we're going to have an issue getting it through. It has been so uncontroversial when you just look at the resolution itself. There's no traps in there or anything like that. It's been a voice vote. We haven't tried to get anybody on the record. I'm not trying to get anyone in trouble back in their district, regardless of what side of the aisle they're on. But what I can absolutely see happening, you know, this time we only had two members speaking. We had myself and we had Representative Diefendorf, who was the sponsor, and we had no one speaking in opposition. And I could see that changing depending on the rhetoric. We saw the rhetoric ramp up considerably around anti-LGBTQ speech last election. Those were some of the worst session days I had. I do not like getting emotional on the floor. And I distinctly remember sobbing at my desk after one particularly rough night after, you know, there had been an anti-LGBTQ rally with my colleagues on the steps. And then we had a late night and it was awful. So I do expect that to ramp up and get worse, but I don't see a problem getting this through next term.
Of course. And then, you know, kind of taking it back to this year and this resolution, it was very emotional as someone who's present on the House floor. And then you keep it to a voice vote. And there, you know, first of all, wasn't much opposition to begin with. But I did hear a few no votes scattered throughout the other side of the room. I guess, what is that like, hearing that and knowing that you know, you have the majority and you have the power to advance that, but those things could change?
Personally, it's hurtful, right? These are people that I work with every single day, and I try to treat with respect, and they could have just been quiet. And instead, they felt that it was imperative that their no vote on this be heard. But that's also their right. You know, they are representatives. Their decisions should not be based around my feelings. And I get that. I don't agree with it. It's something that I keep in mind. But when we talk about the majority, that attitude is why it's very important for me, among other issues, but to hold on to majority. You know, the things that we have been able to do so far this term can be undone. And it is very clear in moments like those, you know, whether I agree with it or not, that there are people who would love to undo some of this progress. So it's really, really important that we communicate what we're doing and we communicate how folks who have been historically not prioritized in the state are being acknowledged and are being prioritized with the legislation that we're passing, but that can also be undone. And I don't mean that to, you know, as a scare tactic for anyone. It's a fact of life. We moved very quickly to get these things in place. They can very quickly be undone as well.
Representative, was there any discussion at all about making the Pride Month resolution a roll call vote and putting Republicans on the record as voting no against that?
Not really. I mean, and no more than any other resolution. Just, you know, is this going to be a record roll call or voice vote? You know, I mean, I adore Speaker Tate for this. He is very good about acknowledging the people in the room and the stake that they have on various issues. And it was asked, you know, do you need it to be a record roll call vote? And granted, it was not my resolution, but everyone in that room was aware of the history with me and the resolution. And the answer was no. I'm not trying to put anyone in a tough place or make any points with this year. I wanted it to be something that not only this time got adopted, but something that we could vocally recognize. And that was the most important thing to me. I didn't want there to be a nasty fight. I didn't want people locking themselves in their caucus room again or anything like that. I wanted it to be a happy moment and a moment of celebration, not something that we were trying to pin people down with.
I see. And the reason I ask that is because it the perception of the LGBTQ community right now, I guess I'm curious your opinion on it because of what we're seeing with Bud Light and Target. It seems like sales are down because they're trying to be sensitive to the community, but then they're seeing hits to their bottom line because of it. So the question is what do you think the perception of the LGBT community is as a society as a whole? Are they accepting?
I think so. I mean, what I can say is that, I mean, and you can pull up my Twitter right now to fact check that. I think that the majority of people, the vast majority of people, are accepting, are either like vocally so, or just frankly don't care because they, you know, it's not their life, it's not their business, and it doesn't matter to them. But what I can say is people who are anti-LGBTQ have gotten much more vocal and much more border, in, I mean, some cases not even bordering, sometimes outright violent with their opposition and really hateful with their rhetoric. You know, I mean, I have never been called the F slur so much in my life as I have over the last the course of like the last year. So it absolutely has ramped up. And that is part of why some of the legislation that we're introducing is being introduced. I had previously introduced a bill to ban the LGBTQ panic defense. So that's a defense that was most notably, well, I shouldn't say most notably used, but most people think of the Matthew Shepard case when they hear about it. So their defense was unsuccessful, but the people that beat Matthew Shepard to death said that it was because he made a pass at them and they were so panicked and afraid and out of sorts that they beat him to death. More often now, it is used against trans women of color in assault cases or murder cases. So I have introduced that bill before. It is more important to me now than it was the last time I introduced it that we get it through, because violence against the LGBTQ community is on the rise. That being said, I don't think that that's because there are more people that oppose our community. It's because of these insidious, frankly, like throwback talking points that people are using, you know, like this groomer narrative and the pedophilia narrative. That's something that hasn't been used in decades because people realized it's not true and it was just homophobic and, you know, meant to incite violence, and it's on the rise again and is inciting violence. So I think it's really important that we recognize the moment we're in and legislate accordingly.
You know, for my final question, and just to confirm before I ask, you are the legislature's first openly bisexual lawmaker, correct?
Correct. And their first female LGBTQ out elected official.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to talk a little bit about the issue of bi visibility within the LGBTQ community. And do you ever feel that because you're bisexual, that sometimes people try to undermine your experiences within the community?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And frankly, I think it's actually not to like put my colleagues on blast, but I think it's actually worse on my side of the aisle because, you know, these are people that I am friends with. So we just have more conversations around it. So there are times where jokes are made or comments are made. You know, I've had friends, like people I love, say like, well, but you're not really queer because you're dating a man. And I mean, yes, I am engaged to a man right now. That doesn't mean that I have never dated women. I have dated women. It's a little frustrating because, you know, I've had to leave places where I was out with girlfriends because it was no longer safe. You know, people saw us holding hands and things got a little scary and we had to leave. And it's a little frustrating because in those moments, nobody stops and asks me, oh, wait, do you also date men? Because it doesn't count. We're not going to hurt you or harass you if you also date men. So I think it's important. And that's part of why I felt the need to give that the speech about the Pride resolution and to make a point about saying that I understand what it's like to feel like you're too much of something for one community and not enough for the other. You know, I mean, I didn't grow up in a supportive home. I was point blank told by my mom, you know, I would love you if you were gay. I would just always wish you weren't. And then, you know, grew up around a bunch of homophobic comments and things like that. So it doesn't matter how many men I've been romantically involved with, the fact that I have been romantically involved with women, I will never be straight enough for my mother. But that being said, I have gay friends who feel like I'm not gay enough because I also date men. So it just, it's tough. And I think that pretty much every bisexual person can relate to that. But part of why I wanted to give that speech was so that even the well-meaning allies that don't realize that what they say is incredibly hurtful and harmful understood. And I will say, like, there was someone who I love dearly, but has made those same crappy jokes, like pulled me aside afterwards and hugged me and said, I want you to know you're enough. you've always been enough. You are more than enough. So yes, I suppose I was making a point for the chamber itself, but also because I know I don't quite understand how or why, but sometimes folks do watch our floor speeches back at home. And I wanted people to understand that there is someone in elected office who is working for them that understands what that's like.
Thank you so much, Representative Pohutsky. Thank you for being on the podcast with us today.
Thank you all very much for having me.
Joining us now on the podcast is Michael Hoover. He is a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. Thank you for taking some time and talking with us today, sir.
Good morning. I'm so pleased to be with you this morning.
Tell our listeners a little bit about your background and who you are.
Sure. From a small town, Michigan, mom and dad were both factory workers. Dad worked at Tecumseh Products. Mom worked at Fisher Body. And then they raised me up in Tecumseh. We also had a little firewood business on the side to help ends meet with my dad. And so I learned early on how to work hard, and that was ingrained in me. We moved to Brooklyn, Michigan, and I got to be a pretty good athlete and ended up having an opportunity to play football at Northwood. Played at Northwood and then got my degree. Went to work for the Dow Chemical Company. Worked there about 8 years and then was able to helped change the front end of our cars, and I got recognized by Dow as well as the Society of Automotive Engineers for the most innovative use of plastics. That led to people around the globe wanting to hire me, and eventually I started my own company because there was a nice good demand for the service of basically doing the same thing I was for Dow, market and technology development. And we have 4 children. We have 9 grandchildren. Just had a baby girl 2 days ago. So we're just one big, happy Hoover family, and we kind of see where things are at with our country. We've been falling off a cliff over the last, I don't know, 10 or so years, and I was asked to consider to run for governor a couple of years ago. It wasn't my time, and after doing a lot of discussion with the people in the political world, as well as the family and pastors, decided to get in for the U.S. Senate, try to restore the American opportunity, the American dream that my wife and I got to enjoy.
We've talked to a number of candidates who've gone to D.C., and they found it sort of not very rewarding. Are you at all concerned you're going to get there and say, this is not what I thought it was going to be?
You know, I think that if we do that, if we start to not stand up and try to make a difference and have hope, then we've already lost. I think that's kind of where I'm at, is that I certainly feel the frustration that a lot of our American people, a lot of our friends and throughout the state feel. But I just have hope. I just have a belief that there is going to be an opportunity. And there seems to be a bit of an American awakening right now. If you look at what happened to Disney or Target or Bud Light, the country is starting to wake up and say, hey, we've got to do something about this.
Do something about what?
Well, I think that they're just sick and tired of not being able to trust their government. I think that's the, you know, whenever you talk to most of the people around, they just don't trust anybody, you know, within the government ranks, particularly D.C. It's just out of control in terms of its spending. Well, let's go back a little bit in time frame that I think we kind of put in perspective. In 99, we were in a pretty good spot. We actually had a balanced budget. Social Security Trust was fully funded. And instead of taking advantage of this great technology that was being born called the internet, we went to wars. We spent trillions of dollars. We bailed out Wall Street. We continued to spend ourselves like drunken sailors. So now we're at $32 trillion. Now we're going to head to $34, $36 trillion in debt. And if you look at how poorly we are doing as a nation, we spend more money on healthcare than any other country, yet we're the sickest. Our education, when I grew up, we were number one. Matter of fact, when I grew up, we were number one in everything. But today, we're number 24th, I think, in math, 38th in science. It's completely unacceptable. And Social Security is deemed to go bankrupt in 9 years. We have a wide open border, and we're financing a war by borrowing money from China.
You mentioned Bud Light and Target. What do you think is going on there?
Yeah, I think that what's going on there is that we have an ideological cult that's been on the move and that says yes to everything. And I think the American people, they just want to go to work. You know, they just want to spend time with their family and friends. They want to raise up their children in loving homes. And I think they've had enough. They've finally got to a point where, you know, you push this this cult, this agenda over into the mainstream of everyday life. And we just don't want any sexualization going on with our children. We've had enough. And so they're starting to push back. So now you see, you know, tens of billions of dollars on loss to these different corporations. And I think that's the American awakening that we're seeing.
Some would say that's being anti-transgender or against the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, so I would say that when it has anything to do with a child or raising, you know, children, that's where the line is drawn. On, you know, if somebody wants to live their life and choose whatever they want to do in their own bedrooms, that's up to them. And, you know, that we live in the land of the free for a reason. What we don't want, and what Americans are saying across the country, is we just don't want it put in the faces of our children, not in our schools, and certainly not in our programs, like a Disney program that we grew up with that was, you know, one of the most pro-children, innocent, pure type of entertainment, types of entertainment we used to have. And so people don't want that coming across as an agenda and as a cult-like approach that it is. They say yes to everything, and American parents are saying no. We say no, thank you.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the state of the Republican Party in Michigan. How do you think it's going? Do you think it's healthy? Is it strong? What do you see there?
Well, obviously, there's been a reshuffling of the deck. You know, I don't know how to best describe it, but you have an old guard and the new guard. I think that it's the sausage is being made, and they're kind of grinding through the process and trying to figure out who's on first and what's on second base. Not to get to Abbott and Costello, but a little bit of that's going on, I suppose. This is one thing I will tell you, though, is that everyone I talk to, doesn't matter if it's what maybe you consider the old guard versus the new guard, 90% of the values are the same. You know, I always talk about whenever I'm talking to somebody that maybe a Trump supporter versus a Reagan supporter or a DeSantis supporter, that, you know, my wife and I don't agree on everything yet. You know, we've been together for almost 41 years. So I think we can figure this out. And when you really talk to the conservatives and talk to the different Republicans, they do get along. It's just a matter about who's going to have the bat in their hands to kind of finish up the thought. So I think at the end of the day, they'll come together. And one of the things that we're doing in our campaign is that, you know, we're Americans and we're about restoring the American opportunity and restoring the American dream. And when I share that message, it doesn't matter what scale or what different people we're talking to, everybody gets on board with that message. So I think we can coalesce and we can agree and unify on something like that.
Tomorrow afternoon, the leading Republican candidate for president gets indicted in Miami. What's your reaction to those charges? And I guess what should happen next? And what do you think?
So it just seems to me that we've got two different set of rules. Hillary Clinton, you know, literally took and had 30,000 names, emails on her server at home. You know, why would she do that? Why was she allowed to do that? That doesn't make any sense to any American. Doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum they're on. That just doesn't seem right. Same thing now with Biden. You know, they found reams of files all over, you know, his home and different places around our country. So it just seems to me that we're going after one side of the party and not the other. And I think it's just wrong. I don't stand for, if someone does something wrong, then it's wrong. You know, we don't make different rules for different people. We hold everybody to the same standard. And that's how we should do this. And if President Trump has done something wrong, then, you know, obviously he needs to go through the process and take care of that. But it just seems to me that the man's, you know, under attack. And I don't know if it's for the reason that they want the Republican Party to coalesce and say that because that's the guy that they want to go against with Biden, or if they're just absolutely trying to kill the man and take him out, so because they're afraid that he can win. So it's a tough, you know, it's try to understand the bigger, longer game here. You know, just try to answer your question directly. I just feel it's we're hurting our country in a bad way. We just continue to divide it.
It's fair enough. There are three cases that are a little different. I mean, Mr. Biden had 30 documents. He welcomed the federal government in to look. Mr. Trump did not. He kept them at bay. He separated out documents specifically to keep them. So they are a little different. I just wanted to note that. I'm not taking a side. I'm just want to make sure.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And the thing is that, but look at Hillary Clinton's. I mean, you know, she had so much data, and I think that there was some stories that came out that some of that was actually stolen away. So, I mean, that's close to treason. Yet, you know, she's no hands on her at all.
Which presidential candidate are you looking at closely this season?
Well, looking at all of them, I think that they all have a lot better plans and values for our country. They're certainly on the side of cutting back all the spending and trying to drive down the inflation. I think they're on the side of, you know, getting our border under control, trying to restore the American opportunity. I am hearing that theme run through, which is kind of interesting because we started with that back in early February when I was the first one to announce the United States Senate. I think there's the other thing that's great when you look at the presidential candidates right now is look at the diversity. You know, we always talk about being the melting pot in here in the United States of America, and we really have that on the Republican Party, so I'm proud to be part of that. So, you know, I think the people will say it. They're gonna speak their voice, and obviously I'm going to cheer for all the above and, you know, hope that we get it right so we can win in 2024.
Who did you support in 2016?
I voted for President Trump.
What about in the primary election?
In the primary, I believe I voted for, I don't know if Rand Paul was still in or not, but if Rand Paul was probably in, I probably voted for him.
How much money do you think you're going to need to raise in order to be successful with this race?
I think to the primary, somewhere between $4 to $6 million, I think is a reasonable amount to get the primary done. In the general, I think it's more like around $50 or $60 million.
Are you going to be a self-funder?
No, I will not be. It's one of the things that we're working on a regular basis. And I'm really pleased that we've been picked up and allowed to speak at the Heritage Foundation, the Freedom Works, at the CNP, and the Club for Growth. So those are, you know, obviously big. Beckett Law was invited to go there as well. So we've been picked up nationally and been able to start to build some relationships across the country for some of the people that can help us get across the finish line.
Republicans are looking for that big name to come into this race, Mr. Hoover. How do you convince Republicans that you are that big name who can take on Alyssa Slotkin in November?
Yeah, I think that you do hear that. It's it's one of the first questions you hear is how much money do you have and how much money are you going to put in? Sadly, that's kind of the state of affairs in politics these days. And really, because we need is to have somebody that's actually going to go fight for the American people, the next generation, restore the American opportunity. So when I hear people talk about money, I just think that you're going down a path guaranteed to lose, because if that's your number one priority, you're going to swing and miss again. And we don't want to do that. We want to make sure that somebody that can reach out to the working class, somebody that can work out to suburbia, somebody that's actually lived in the city of Detroit, somebody that actually brought home a young man into his home, into our home from Flint. So we've got those kind of connections. Someone that's lived in the farm and worked in the country. And somebody understands the true values of what it means to be an American.
I understand that you have some kids who are pretty good athletes as well.
I do. I sure do. So my oldest son, he played football for Eastern Michigan, All-State at Novi. And then my next son, he was an All-American at Novi, was the Rose Bowl team captain, champion, had a little time stint in the NFL with the Colts and the Eagles. And then my youngest daughter was an amazing athlete herself. She was the state champ, most valuable player at Novi Soccer. So all of those three. And then my oldest daughter, she played varsity basketball in Pinckney, actually. So, yeah, the Hoover family will have some bloodlines coming down, because now with the 9 grandchildren, you know, those kids are going to be pretty good athletes, too.
Anything else you want to say about your campaign, or anything you want to say to people who are wondering, should we be taking this guy seriously?
Well, I think so. The fact that D.C. has taken me seriously, the Heritage, all the major organizations that are on the side of freedom, that tells, you know, that should say a lot. I think also just from the standpoint that I truly have lived the American dream. I have had 4 gifts in my life. And the first one was born, you know, in this country. The second was when I was 17 years old, I learned I was going to be a father. And when I was 18 years old, I was running a track meet, and I found out that my daughter had been born. And I went to the hospital, and I fed her, and I named her, and I actually brought her home, thanks to my parents helping me out. And then that was my second gift. My third gift was my beautiful wife. She happened to be my new high school sweetheart, and she stayed with me, and We ended up raising a family. We went through hard times. We had four children by the ages of 24 and 27. And we just lived in a real small home, and we dedicated ourselves to our family. My wife stayed home, and we drove used cars, and we ate pot pies. And sometimes she would take a second job just to help make ends meet. And the last gift was getting the opportunity at Dow Chemical, where I helped change the industry for, you know, improving our fuel economy. And then that led me to being able to start my own company, where I recycled over 500 million pounds. We could fill up Ford Field 3,000 times of plastic bottle waste. So it did something that's actually great for America in terms of finding a solution for our plastic waste. So the fact that we came from absolutely nothing and then, you know, being able to live this American dream and overcome and just kept working hard, and that's something that I'm going to dedicate and give, and I'll give it until I'm gone.
U.S. Senate candidate Michael Hoover, thank you so much for joining us here on this edition of the MERS Money podcast.
It was an absolute pleasure. I appreciate you having me here this morning.
Joining us now on the podcast is the chair of the State Officers Compensation Commission, the illustrious former representative, Tom Cochran. How you doing, Tom?
Well, that's questionable, Kyle. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Give our listeners a little bit of your background, though, because you were a state legislator, but prior to that, you worked in city government for a long time.
For 30 years. I retired in 2012. It was the last 6 years I was chief of Lansing Fire Department, paramedic firefighter. I also served on the Mason School Board for 10 years. So, and then when I retired, I was approached by some people to run for office, and it happened to work out with term limits. I was able to run for State House, the 67th House District, which was a portion of Lansing and pretty much rural Ingham County.
So you have a little bit of experience in municipal and public service and the people who are elected to serve us.
Indeed. And then, you know, it's I always looked at my, people would say politician, I always looked at myself as a public servant. And it goes back to my background as a firefighter. I always felt, you know, just, it was a wonderful career. I always enjoyed giving back to the community. Used to do a lot of things on the side just for like blood pressure. We go to the city market and do blood pressure for people, and it just really trying to stay in touch with people and do good work. And I felt, you know, I'm a real believer in government. I think it's a quality thing. I think it does a lot of good, like anything, and there's negatives to it as well, but I think there's a lot of positives that come out of it. I ran for school board, and that was probably one of the toughest positions I ever held. We closed a school in Mason at the time due to population, and then they ended up reopening it like 10 years later. But then again, I said I ran for State House, and that was a great experience. I really like the doors. I did a lot of doors and talked to a lot of people, trying to get a feel for what, you know, what their concerns are, and any way that I could help. I think I shocked a few people and upset a couple. I would many times in my office, I'd be in my office a lot, and when I wasn't at other things, but I would answer my own phone, and people would, they were shocked that, you know, is this really Tom Cochran? Am I talking to, you know, my staff would get mad at me, you know, the caucus would get mad at me, and it's like, what are you doing answering your phone? Well, again, I just felt strongly about working for people and trying to do what was right.
So. There you go. Now, you are also currently, right, chair of the State Officers Compensation Commission.
I am.
And prior to your becoming chair, the group did make a recommendation on some pay changes. Talk about those.
Well, yes. And I was approached about applying for the position, the commission, and I did. And, I didn't have a lot of knowledge of the commission. I knew that they existed. And, you know, the commission makes recommendations to the legislatures. And legislation, and they have to approve any recommendations that are made. Bob Emerson had been the chair, and I've known Bob a long time. Bob has a storied history in Lansing, and, you know, well known and respected. You know, I was looking forward to it. And then my good friend Joan Bauer got on the commission as well, and so I just thought it was something that was important. It's the host. process is interesting. You know, they only meet every other year, in an odd year, number year, and they can, you can only make a recommendation. And this year, you know, we had Lawrence Nolan was one of our commissioners, made a recommendation of a 25% increase across the board. And
nobody voted for it.
No. I felt bad. I think, you know, he was very, very passionate about it. He, you know, I don't, if you know the man or not, he's a elder, you know, I myself being elderly, he's a older gentleman, an attorney, and just felt very strongly that, you know, that these individuals need to have a pay raise. And I think for the most part, the commission as a whole felt that way as well. 25% was, you know, it was a long reach. There's no way that was going to happen. And so, again, it wasn't supported.
If we go back and we take a look at how much our public officials make, the governor makes $159,000, right, and the attorney general and the secretary of state make $112,000,
right,
correct? And then our legislators make $71,000 a year,
correct,
and the Supreme Court justices, they make a little bit more.
It's $181,000.
Okay.
And they do not get an expense account. They are 17% below the average of justices in the comparison states. You know, like anything, they do comparisons, and they're 34th in ranking of all 50 states.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, how is it that they fell behind? Is it just because they're part of the SOCC process and the lower court judges aren't?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes, the Court of Appeals judges now, they still make the same increase annually as state employees. The legislature put them on the same schedule. So if state employees, let's say, receive a 3% increase a year, the Court of Appeals judges would receive that same 3% increase. And I think at the time, the thinking from legislators were that this would push the issue of Supreme Court salaries, and there would be some type of fix that was made to make their salaries comparable so that we wouldn't have a situation where Court of Appeals judges ultimately made more than the Supreme Court justices, but that really didn't happen. Instead, we were stuck with the same SOC process and the whims of the legislature to approve those increases. So we'll have to see if that's what they end up doing. But I wanted to change gears here with you, Tom. The governor, like we said earlier, makes $159,000 a year. If not that salary, how much do you believe that position should pay?
How much do I think the governor should make? Well, for the most part, all the department heads, with a couple of exceptions, veterans and Board of Education, they make 180 plus, 81, 82. I think the governor should make, in my opinion, should make closer to $200,000 at least. I think part of the concern, and I know I'm not the only one that feels this way, is that to get the quality of people that we want. We want someone in there that's going to work for the people of Michigan and not be sidelined by, you know, the idea of additional monies that could be there and, you know, as far as donations and those sort of things. I think, you know, when people, and I'm not to say that that happens, we know it happens in politics, and but I think if you pay someone a quality salary, you know, that they're going to be more apt to be where they should be and be honest and be, you know, be the kind of person that we want in those positions. I believe we have, with our elected officials, as far as, you know, our governor, lieutenant governor, justices, I think we have some really quality people, our certainly attorney general and our secretary of state. And I think, you know, we need to have people that are compensated for the work that they do. You know, Dana Nessel is over 500 people working for this for the Attorney General's office. And, you know, we talked earlier the idea that if you go to a law firm with someone that's, you know, the head of a law firm that has that many lawyers, I can't even imagine. I probably wouldn't know what that figure would be.
Yeah, she makes $112,000. What do you think that salary should be? That should be $252,000, shouldn't it?
I definitely should be over $200,000, without a doubt. And I would say push, you know, and even closer to 250, in my opinion. And again, it's not about the individual that's in the position. And I think that's what people get focused on is they, you know, they, the politics of it, there's a lot of people, I won't say a lot of people, but there's certainly the Republicans, a number of Republicans that don't care for Dana Nessel and her politics and the work that she does. Personally, I think she's doing a phenomenal job. I think she's very busy. You know, I would never want to get on that woman's bad side because she's like a bulldog, and she doesn't rest. And she's got a lot of quality people working for her. And she's got people working for her that are making a whole lot more money than she does. You know, that's part of the problem is that you think, again, as I said, with the department heads, you know, we've got department heads that are making 180 plus thousand upwards to $200,000, making more money than the people, their bosses.
Now, part of the problem is that the State Officers Compensation Commission sort of created their own handicap in a way. Back in the early aughts, they put through a 38% increase. And Kyle, you were talking earlier about how that changed the process. It led to a change in the whole system.
So the process back in 2000 was that the State Officers Compensation Commission would make recommendations on the salaries for the legislature and the executive office and the Supreme Court. And the legislators would vote no if they didn't want them. And if the legislature didn't vote no, then they would automatically go through. Well, what happened in 2000 is that SOC recommended a 38% increase for legislatures. And the House said no, since they were up for election in 2000. And the Senate, they were not up for re-election. In fact, many of them were term limited. They didn't do anything because, you know, among other things, it was going to help their pension. And many of these legislators were termed out. So this 38% pay increase went into effect and created this huge uproar to the point that these very same legislators who were getting termed out said, well, we got to change the process because the process here is broken. And what we're going to do is we're going to put up a constitutional amendment going forward that says that the SOC recommendations need affirmative approval from both the House and the Senate in order for them to go through. And I think we know what happened after that. None of the SOC recommendations outside of one Supreme Court pay raise has ever gotten approved. So now we're in a situation where the legislators, the governor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state are all vastly underpaid. And there's no real good way. And to get them to a pay rate that's probably similar to other states, they would have to take a political vote that they don't want to take.
And you were a lawmaker. Would you want to go back to your constituents and say, hey, I just have voted through a 10% pay hike for myself?
No. And that would be the kiss of death for a lot of people. You know, and that's the unfortunate part. You know, I think there's a lot of people that are struggling, not just in this state, but in the country. And I think that for them as legislators to go and approve a pay raise for themselves, it would be the kiss of death. I mean, you could see, you know, the mailings and the there would be people coming at you.
It's an invite for a primary.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Tom Cochran voted himself a 10% pay increase, and you know that people would just be coming after you like crazy. And you know, and it's just unfortunate. Because again, my concern is, and I think the concern of others is that the quality of people that we're getting in these positions. I talked about earlier. If we have young people that, and again, I think it's important that we get a lot of young people involved in the system and in the politics. And if you have them, and you know, theoretically, they could be in office for 14 years now. So you're talking someone in their 20s or 30s coming out 14 years later, and then they have to find a job. Mm-hmm. Barring the fact that many of them go to work for lobbyists and other positions, but that's a whole nother conversation that we could have. But you know, it's just difficult, and I think a number of people go into these run for office for varied reasons. I mean, I think many of them come into it wanting to make a difference and trying to do good work for their communities and for the people. Not everyone does that, but I think we need to pay them a quality wage and something that they can be able to support themselves and their families with at least. You know, that's just my opinion, mm-hmm. And I don't think I'm the only one that feels that way.
Term limits was seen as an intractable problem for a long time, and it was resolved last election cycle. How do you see this being resolved? Or are we going to just continue to struggle along?
I think it's going to continue to struggle along. I think, you know, we're going to have some conversations. As chair, I'm going to have some conversations, and I know they have in the past, and what we could do as far as making a recommendation to try. I'd like to see that I don't know how, if it would be a group, you know, obviously legislators would have to be involved, other electeds, and to sit down and say, you know, what would be the right thing to do here and how could we make that happen? But again, you know, it would take a constitutional change, and that's, as we know, it can be extremely difficult. Although, you know, they have had some recently, term limits was changed, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's not an impossibility. But how do you sell it? How do you get people to agree to it?
You'd almost have to say we're taking pay raises out of the hands of the politicians, and we're just going to set the rate and then put it at autopilot.
You almost have to run it as an anti-politician effort.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to set their rate at the average rate of what everybody makes.
We're going to change this. We're going to take the issue out of the greedy hands of the politicians, and we're going to solve it ourselves.
There you go. You guys got it right there.
There you go. And then you
think we've been around for a while or something?
Yeah, it's almost like we've seen this kind of thing before. You know, you just take the average salary of all the governors in the country and say, this is the average salary for the governor, the average salary for legislators. Now, the legislators, though, they would get jobbed on this because a lot of these legislators are part-time.
Right.
And so they don't make a lot of money. But in Michigan, it's full-time.
Right.
$70,000, you would say they'd make... What do you think they should make? 80, 85?
You know, 70 isn't bad. I think they should make closer to 80, 85,000. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think 70's, I mean, if you look at comparable positions, and again, it's everyone's different. I mean, I know when I worked in the state house, it was 40, 50, mostly 50, 60 hour weeks. And again, a lot of time away at night from home. And going to functions and meeting with constituents and just being out there. And I think that would be a fair compensation. 80 to 85,000 would be fair for legislators. We could go across the board and say, you know, what we talked about the governor, the governor should be over 200,000 and 225, even pushing up to 250. Certainly the Secretary of State and Attorney General should be, you know, I think, as much as, again, you look at the department heads and the majority of the department
heads. And they are department directors.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right, John. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're department directors. And they're making, you know, $60,000, $70,000 less than all the other department heads are making.
Right. And then the Supreme Court justices, you could set the same thing if they could be at, what, 250 probably? As folks almost, with legal degrees, they should be at 250.
You could almost make it a factor of whatever the averages for the trial court judges, 1.5 or 1.6 or whatever you think is fair.
Mm-hmm. But again, that's going to have to be a sell to the public, and the legislators can't lead on that. It would have to be another kind of coalition, which is what happened with the term limits law, where you had unions and business come together and create something and try and get the ball rolling.
That'd be an interesting conversation to try to get the ball rolling. I think that's definitely where it would have to be.
It is in those interest groups' interest to have qualified, competent, well trained legal thinkers in the Supreme Court.
Oh, absolutely.
They make decisions that have a huge impact on the business climate.
Yeah, and if you want the best, because if you don't have good salaries, then you would need somebody to come in who could take the pay cut and would be willing to take the pay cut. Right. And if not, then what are their other ulterior motives for wanting to be in those positions of power?
Exactly. Well, and that's an excellent point. I mean, in my position, I had retired from a 30-year career. And, and I was still young enough. I felt that I had some more to give as a public servant. And that's why I ran for office, you know, trying to make a difference. I was served in the minority and there are times where you're able to help. A lot of it's the constituent work that you do and try to make a difference in helping someone navigate state government or whatever that might be. But you're right. I was able to do that. And yet with younger people, they don't have, anything to fall back on. They have to make a living. You know, they have to be able to support their family as well.
Creates an incentive for people in their 20s to run and people who are post-career to run. Mm-hmm. And then you're leaving the middle out.
And you're leaving the middle out, exactly. The people that could be in the private sector making a lot more money.
And if they got kids and mortgages and colleges to pay for. And
take care.
Well,
take care.
As part of the State Officers Compensation Commission, you brought all those issues out, and you put a proposal on the table for lawmakers to at least bump up the salary for Supreme Court justices. What do you think the odds are that they're going to do anything with that?
I think that one might be a possibility. And Bob Emerson did his diligence and contacted, the Quad and talked to the leaders of both houses, the state and the Senate, and talked to some other people as well. And I think that's a possibility. We'll see where it goes. I'm not sure, where they're at with that. I've not heard. I was going to reach out to Bob and some other people to see, if that was moving at all or it's going to. But I could very well see it not going anywhere as well, too. Because again, it's that somebody's going to throw it back in your face. Kyle Mullen voted for raises for the Supreme Court justices, and here I'm struggling at home, and
Yep, inflation's killing us all.
That Kyle Mullen, he's just
I know, it's terrible. Tom, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Jeff Smith, who's filling in for Mark Bayshore in doing our audio today. Also, thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. We'd like to thank our guest, Tom Cochran, former state representative and State Officers Compensation Commission chair, for coming in and joining us. Also, thanks to the Speaker Pro Tem, Lori Pohutsky, and also Michael Hoover, U.S. Senate candidate. For the boss, John Ruhring, Samantha Schreiber, and Danielle James, I'm Kyle Mullen. Until next week, take care.